Today is Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. Welcome to the Minnesota Senate Taxes Committee. I believe we're going to start by referring a bill to the Subcommittee on Property Taxes. Senate File 4455 will be moved to the Subcommittee on Property Taxes. Is that all I have to do for that? Okay, great. Now to the main agenda for the day. Senator Nelson, I believe you have a motion for Senate File 3692.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll just take Senate File 3692 off the table.
Senator Nelson moves Senate File 3692 be removed from the table. Senator Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, this is the much-awaited omnibus tax bill. And before we start, I just want members to know that this is what I had wanted to be an early action tax bill, which always comes a little later than we had hoped. But this is the tax bill that we'll be dealing with three issues largely and one tangentially or additionally. And that is, members, this tax bill will deal with conformity, which this tax committee knows is important to Minnesota tax filers. And it deals with conformity items. Actually, it is the governor's conformity items from his budget proposal. It does not include any conformity items that increase Minnesota taxpayers' liability, but it will make it easier for Minnesotans to file those taxes and also reap the benefits of some of those federal tax treatments as well. And in addition, this bill will do much needed tax relief. Minnesota continues to be a high taxed state. We're at a time where our state coffers are full, and yet Minnesotans are struggling. So we'll talk more about that later, but just to finish setting the table here, the other things that will be in the bill besides conformity that you will see in front of you are also reducing the first tier tax rate to 2.8% from 5.35%. And just to make sure everyone realizes every Minnesotan's income tax rate will receive treatment from that lower tax rate. And then in addition, something that I think just about everyone on this tax committee has proposed at one time or another, and that is removing the double taxation on Social Security benefits. Minnesotans bought those benefits year after year, paycheck after paycheck, and then they come and want to reap those benefits, and our state is one of a handful that will tax those benefits. So those are the three big items in the bill. I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Pollack to give you a formal bill walkthrough.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair, members, I will walk through the various provisions of the two articles of the bill. And then I believe Mr. Wilms will walk through the spreadsheet. Article 1 is the federal update article that Chair Nelson referenced. Section 1 of the bill updates the reference date for the definition of the Internal Revenue Code in the Tax Administration chapter. Section 2 updates some cross-references to the definition of composite income for conformity modifications in later sections for two meals expensing, the special limited adjustment, and delayed business interest. Section 3 updates the reference date for the Internal Revenue Code for purposes of the definition of net income. And Section 4 updates the reference date for the definition of Internal Revenue Code in the in Chapter 290, the Income and Corporate Franchise chapter. So by updating the reference date to the definition of the Internal Revenue Code and for purposes of the definition of the calculation of net income, the bill conforms to a number of federal provisions. Starting back with the Further Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2019, conformity here would allow expansion of allowable uses of Section 529 plans to include payments for certain student loans and apprenticeship programs. It would allow a 7-year depreciation schedule for motorsports entertainment complexes to allow these facilities the same depreciation schedule as theme parks and amusement parks. Conformity to the CARES Act from 2020 would include a few provisions here, increasing the limit on the deduction for qualifying contributions of food inventory items from 15% to 25% of modified income, including certain over-the-counter medical products as qualified medical expenses, and increasing the limit on charitable deductions from 10% of modified income to 25% for corporations. From the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021 would include some provisions to exclude from gross income discharge of indebtedness on a qualified principal residence, excluding from gross income certain state payments to volunteer firefighters and emergency responders, exclusion of up to $5,250 of employer payments of employee student loans, up to $300 in an above-the-line deduction for cash charitable contributions made by non-itemizers. This would be $600 for married joint filers. Increase of the limitation of the deduction for individuals for cash charitable contributions from 60% of modified income to 100%, and from 10%, for 60% of modified income to 100% for individuals, and from 10% of modified income to 25% for corporations. Exclusion of gross income of SBA loans, exclusion from gross income of shuttered venue grants, accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations. This provision would allow businesses to depreciate expenses more rapidly for property used predominantly in the active conduct of a trade or business within an Indian reservation. Depreciation allowance of certain residential rental property over 30 years instead of 40 years for property placed in service before 2018. Previously, property placed in service before 2018 was subject to a 40-year recovery period. Special expensing rules for certain film, television, and live theatrical productions. The allowance of the energy-efficient commercial building deduction. This allows a deduction in the year the building is placed in service for installation of certain energy-efficient systems that reduce the building's total energy and power costs by 50% or more in comparison to a building that has that meets established minimum standards. A special rule for the production of beer, wine, and distilled spirits to exclude the longer aging period of these products from the production period for purposes of interest capitalization rules. By excluding these products from that production period, producers of beer, wine, and distilled spirits may deduct interest expenses that are attributable to a shorter period of time. Special rules for disaster-related use of retirement funds. These include allowing tax on income attributable to disaster-related contributions to be paid over 3 years, recontributing to qualified amounts within 3 years regardless of the contribution limits for a given year, allowing recontribution of hardship withdrawals intended for home purchases, and increasing the maximum amount of loans from qualifying retirement plans from the lesser of 50% of the balance, or $50,000, to the lesser of 100% of the balance, or $100,000. Special rules for disaster-related personal casualty losses to allow individuals with qualified personal casualty losses in a qualified disaster area to deduct unreimbursed amounts in excess of $500. And then non-itemizers would be allowed an increase in the standard deduction in the net amount of the disaster loss. And then finally, under the CARES Act, this conforms to special rules for contributions made by corporations to allow a deduction of up to 100% of taxable income for contributions made to qualifying charities in a qualified disaster area. Turning to the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, this would conform to increasing the amount of the maximum investment income allowed to qualify for the earned income tax credit and therefore the Minnesota Working Family Credit, an increase in the exclusion amount for employer-provided dependent care assistance. This pertains to the pre-tax amount that employees may contribute to the employer-provided dependent care assistance accounts. Exclusion from gross income for forgiven student loans. Extension of the limitation on excess business losses for non-corporate taxpayers. The cap on the deduction was scheduled to expire at the end of 2025 and has been extended through 2026. Exclusion from gross income of EIDL or EIDL advances, economic injury disaster loan advances. Exclusion from gross income of restaurant revitalization grants. Repeal of the worldwide interest allocation rules. This was a provision enacted in the early 2000s to allow a worldwide group to make a one-time election to allocate interest expenses of each domestic corporation that was a member of the group. The effective date of this provision was delayed several times, but finally became effective in 2020, and then the ARPA repealed these rules, so this would conform to the repeal. Denial of the deduction for certain highly compensated executives. Under current law, the deductions for employee wages extend to certain covered employees that include a group of executives and other highly compensated employees. This is effective through 2026, and the conformity extends the effective date of that limitation. And then finally, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021. Conformity here would allow tax-exempt private activity bonds for qualified broadband projects and for funding carbon capture technologies projects. Interest in private activity bonds is generally taxable unless the bond is specifically included as a qualified private activity bond. So the IIJA allowed private activity bonds for these projects tax-exempt status. And then finally, under the IIJA, modification of the tax treatment of contributions of capital to exclude contributions to a regulated public utility for water or sewage disposal services. So those would be the items that the bill proposes to conform to. I'll continue on through the rest of the article. Section 5 specifies that taxpayers must use earned income from the current taxable year for purposes of calculating the Minnesota standard deduction for taxpayers who are dependents. Section 6 and 7 require add-backs for individual filers for the excess of the 50% limitation on the deduction of meal expenses and for the special limited nonconformity adjustment if the net adjustment increases net income. And I will describe the nonconformity adjustment in just a few minutes. Sections 8 through 10 provide subtractions for certain net operating losses that would have been allowed for federal income tax purposes. The special limited nonconformity adjustment if the adjustment reduces net income and for a certain amount of delayed business interest resulting from the nonconformity adjustment. Sections 11 and 12 require add-backs for corporate filers for the excess of the 50% limitation on the deduction for meal expenses and for the special limited nonconformity adjustment if the adjustment decreases net income. Sections 13 and 14 provide subtractions for the special limited nonconformity adjustment if the adjustment reduces net income and for a certain amount of delayed business interest resulting from the nonconformity adjustment. This provision would apply to corporations. Section 15 updates cross-references for purposes of calculating the non-resident income tax to include modifications to conformity provisions elsewhere in the bill. Section 16 specifies that taxpayers must use earned income from the current taxable year for purposes of calculating the working family credit. And Section 17 specifies that taxpayers must also use earned income for the current taxable year for purposes of calculating the marriage penalty credit. Section 18 is an update of cross-references for purpose of calculating AMT to include modifications to the conformity items throughout this article. Section 19 allows the unused portion of a net operating loss carryover or carryback arising in tax years 2018 or 2019 that would have been allowed at the federal level under the Internal Revenue Code as amended through December 31 of 2018 to be carried forward for up to 20 years. And then Section 20 provides a special limited adjustment or kind of a one-time reconciliation for taxpayers who reported nonconformity adjustments on their returns for tax years 2017 to 2021 as a result of nonconformity to various tax provisions during those years. The nonconformity items that are listed in this section would the adjustment would not include the items that are included in this section of the bill. The adjustment amount equals the difference in FAGI for individual filers or FTI for corporate filers of the amount calculated as of Minnesota's last conformity date of provisions in the IRC, in the Internal Revenue Code, that were in the 2021 special session omnibus tax bill, and the amount calculated under the Internal Revenue Code as it has been amended through November 15th of 2021. Section 21 is an update of the reference date for the definition of the Internal Revenue Code in the property tax refund chapter. And Section 22 is similarly an update to the reference date for the definition of Internal Revenue Code in the estate tax chapter. Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of Article 1. I'll just briefly walk through Article 2, which is the income and estate tax article. Sections 1, 2, 3, 7, and 8 include provisions to strike obsolete language regarding the phase-in of the estate tax exclusion amount and to allow for portability of a deceased spouse's unused exclusion amount. Section 4 allows a full subtraction of taxable Social Security benefits. Section 5 reduces the first-tier income rate from 5.35% to 2.8%. And then it also updates the four income tax brackets for inflation as provided under current law. And Section 6 updates the statutory year for the inflation requirement that I just mentioned for Section 5. Madam Chair, that concludes the summary of Article 2.
Thank you, Ms. Pollack. Members, any questions for Senator Nelson or Council? Mr. Wilms, then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jay Wilms, the fiscal analyst for the Tax Committee. I'll now be walking through the Senate fiscal tracking document that you should all have in your packets and was passed out to members in the audience. So the document is titled Senate Fiscal Tracking, and it overviews the estimated effects of to the general fund from these tax policy changes by the A3 delete all amendment. Couple minor things to note. The forecast baseline is the February 22nd forecast baseline. The spreadsheet is comprised of several sections. The first two relate to conformity and they detail the individual income tax changes and then the corporate franchise tax changes. And then the next section looks at the additional tax policy changes which aren't related to conformity, and those are related to the individual income tax and the estate tax. So the subtotal for conformity changes is on line 50. The subtotal for those additional tax policy changes is on line 60. And the total for the general fund tax revenue changes is on line 70. But just briefly going through, beginning with the start of the document, you can see there are columns A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, aligning, referencing or pinpointing a certain number. Column A can list the federal act, as my colleague Ms. Pollack, during her walkthrough, identify the different provisions from the various federal acts that's provided for reference. Column B is the effective dates, and then columns E and H are the biennial totals. Line one is related to the expansion of Section 529 plans. The estimated effects in the first biennium are a reduction of $530,000. Line two increases the charitable deduction for limit for food inventory. From 15 to 25%. That's an estimated reduction in the current biennium of $200,000. The next is the inclusion of certain over-the-counter medical products as qualified medical expenses. That has a negligible effect. Line four relates to the modifications on exclusion of discharge indebtedness through short sales and other principal reduction measures that's effective for tax year 21 through 25, and estimated $3 million reduction in the first biennium, and in the second biennium, $3.2 million reduction. Skipping ahead a little to line six, that looks at the exclusion for certain employer payments of student loans. That would be effective for tax year 21 through 25, and the estimated effect is $13.9 million reduction in the first biennium and a $14.7 million reduction in the second biennium. Line 7 details the one-time partial above-the-line deduction for charitable contributions. That's for tax year 21 only, so you can see the fiscal effects are isolated to 1 year, a reduction of $13.9 million in general fund revenues for FY23 only. Skipping ahead now to, well, actually going to line 8, the modification of the limitation on charitable contributions. That's for tax year 21 only, but there's some estimated shifting in terms of the effect of future charitable contributions on that, which shows a revenue gain in the tails as a result in comparison to baseline. Line 9 shows the small business assistance loan assistance exclusion, and that relates to some of the principal payments and relief provided by SBA through some of their COVID relief measures. The effects of that are $2.7 million in the first biennium and a smaller effect, $400,000, in the next. And then skipping ahead now to line 10, the shuttered venue grants income. That's a reduction of $2.3 million to the individual income tax. There's also a corporate franchise tax effect identified later. Moving on to line 11, line 12, that details the depreciation of certain residential rental property over 30 years instead of 40 years. The effect of that is $8.2 million in the first biennium, and then in the tails, $2 million. And as you can see, there's a retroactive impact to tax year 18, so that's why the FY23 number is higher than the rest. Line 13 shows the special expensing rules for certain film, TV, and live theatrical productions. Reduction of $3.3 million in the first biennium. And then I think we'll skip down to line 22 to show the effects of the exclusion of the EIDL loans, similar to the SBA loan assistance and the Paycheck Protection Program. Those were additional SBA measures provided to those who applied for business relief. And then line 23 shows the exclusion of restaurant revitalization grants, reduction of $4.2 million. Estimated in the current biennium. And then lines 24 and 25 detail the IIJA modifications to tax-exempt bonding. So the subtotal for line 26 of federal conformity income tax changes is $68.4 million in estimated revenue reductions. And then for the second biennium, $23.8 million in estimated revenue reductions. Moving on to the next page, which is the federal conformity section now for the corporate franchise tax. Lines 28, 29, and 33, those show the 7-year recovery period for motorsports entertainment complexes. Those are corporate franchise tax effects only. And it extends the temporary provision that was originally enacted in 2004. And moving on to line 30, another increase to the limitation on charitable contributions. This relates to corporate cash contributions, as previously detailed by my colleague, Ms. Pollack. Lines 31, 32, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38 all were discussed previously, either by Ms. Pollack or above. Those also have individual income tax effects. Line 40 and line 41 also has effects that are detailed above. The real largest items in the corporate franchise tax effects are on line 31, the small business loan assistance exclusion, the exclusion of shuttered venue grants, the depreciation of residential real estate property, the special expensing for theatrical productions, and then the EIDL advances and the restaurant revitalization grants. So moving down to the subtotal in line 45, the estimated effects to the corporate franchise tax is a reduction in general fund revenues of $26.5 million in the first biennium and $6.8 million in the second biennium. So line 50 shows the conformity changes subtotal of $94.9 million in reduction and $30.6 million in estimated changes. Now moving on to the next section of the tracking, which details the changes to the individual income tax. Line 52 shows the effects, the estimated effects of reducing the first bracket rate to 2.8%. This is a reduction of 2.55 percentage points. Moves from 5.35 to 2.8%. So for fiscal year 23, it's effective for tax year 22, but the first effects are carried in fiscal year 23. And as you'll note in the tracking, the first year effect is slightly higher than the next annual effects in FY 24 and 25, and that's due to the 1.5 year effect, which kind of gets at the misalignment of the calendar year in the tax year versus our fiscal year. So the estimated effect is $2.82 billion in tax reductions to the general fund for FY 23. And then approximately $2 billion annually thereafter, and you can see the number slightly changes based on macroeconomic assumptions about the level of income in Minnesota. The estimate is prepared using DOR stratified, random stratified sample of a prior tax year. And also in your packets, there should be some information, a distributional analysis. Detailing the effects of the rate cut for various income thresholds throughout this. What I'll finally say about that is 2.4 million taxpayers would see a reduction of income taxes, estimated of $760 average decrease for all filers. For married filing jointly, this results in an estimated or a maximum reduction under this policy. Excluding any effects of credits of about $1,050. For married separate, it'd be about half that, $523. For single filers, about $716. For head of household, about $882,000. And that corresponds really to where the first bracket ends in terms of calculating that benefit. So moving on to line 53, that's the 100% subtraction of Social Security income that's effective in tax year 22. The treatment of this is really similar to how we budget for a credit. So all of the tax year 22 effects are allocated to the following fiscal year. So in this case, we only show a one-year effect, tax year 22 in fiscal 23. The estimated reduction is $510 million approximately. And then based on the growth in assumptions of Social Security income and benefit recipients, it rises to $550 million approximately in the next fiscal year and $580 million approximately in the next year for a total reduction in the tails of $1.12 billion. Line 54 really details the interaction between these two proposals, and it shows that by enacting a full subtraction of Social Security income, there's less income the rate cut is applied to. So it, in a sense, makes the first bracket rate cut cheaper. And so that interaction really shows the effects of that. And so line 58, skipping ahead now, details the spousal exclusion portability on the estate tax. And then getting to line 60, we show the additional tax policy changes. So these are the income tax changes and the estate tax changes. And then line 70 shows all of it combined, the estimated general fund tax revenue changes of the conformity and the individual income and estate tax changes. And the estimated impact is a reduction in net tax revenue of $3.38 billion in FY23. And $5.04 billion in FY24-25. And that concludes the walkthrough, unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wilms. Members, any questions for Mr. Wilms? Seeing none, we'll begin with our kind of lengthy list of testifiers here. I believe we're starting with Commissioner Doty. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. We have on deck after this Claire Luger. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 3692 as amended. For the record, my name is Robert Doty. I am the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue appreciates the work this committee has done to assemble this bill, specifically on the area of federal conformity. We all agree on the importance of responding to the federal tax changes enacted since our tax statutes were last updated in 2019. Individual taxpayers, CPAs, and businesses have all expressed the need to update our tax code to reduce complexity and compliance cost. This bill adopts the governor's approach to update the general conformity date and provide important conformity for individuals and businesses. We appreciate this important provision. We look forward to continuing to work with members of the committee and stakeholders on the best approach to administer this update that could impact multiple years of returns and adjustments for taxpayers. Unfortunately, this bill misses the opportunity to target tax relief to Minnesotans who need it the most. This bill has a large price tag, but does not increase the fairness of our tax system by helping low to middle income Minnesotans or allow for significant investments in public services as part of the rest of the budget. The primary focus of the bill is an income tax rate cut that will benefit Minnesotans in the top deciles of income. The bill also provides a subtraction for all Social Security income, again benefiting our highest earners. Social Security recipients already pay tax on only a portion of their Social Security income. After the federal exclusion and Minnesota subtraction, about 53% of recipients pay no state tax on benefits. The bill also provides relief for the wealthiest Minnesotans through changes to the estate tax to allow a larger amount of the estate to go untaxed. The governor's supplemental budget puts everyday Minnesotans at the center of his budget, including expanding eligibility for the refundable tax credits that help families struggle to make ends meet. These critical tax changes are not included in the committee's bill. These include expanding the Child and Dependent Care Credit to recognize the challenges Minnesota parents face in paying for quality, affordable child care. Secondly, expanding the K-12 Education Credit for families with school expenses for their children. And finally, expanding the Working Family Credit and Homeowner Property Tax Credit to include individuals who pay tax using an individual taxpayer identification number. The department would like to reaffirm our commitment to making sure policies included in the final tax bill can be administered well for the taxpayers you intend to benefit with these policy choices. We will continue to share policy and administrative concerns as we continue our review of the bill. Finally, I want to thank Chair Nelson and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for your partnership thus far, and we look forward to a productive dialogue as we move towards the end of session.
Thank you, Commissioner. Up next, we have Claire Luger on deck, Dr. Kelly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Claire Luger, and I'm a special education teacher in White Bear Lake. Thank you for the time to testify today. I'll also thank my colleagues for stepping into sub for me while I'm here today. We have a statewide sub shortage, and most districts don't have the funds to pay a decent wage for doing so. I'm here today to express my dismay at the lack of insight about funding our public education in the Senate tax bill, both as an educator and as a parent. State funding of public education hasn't kept up for 20 years, and that is unacceptable. My school has 3 counselors for 1,200 students. How do we expect students to learn if their mental health needs aren't being met? We've got class sizes of 38 students, and special education support staff transitioning between 2 to 3 classrooms per hour to support students because it's difficult to hire qualified individuals for challenging but low-paying jobs. In my home district, we have an average of 5 bus route cancellations per day because no one wants the low-paying job of being a bus driver. That's over 100 students from tax-paying families who need to find a way to school on any given day. You have the opportunity to reverse that. We can invest now, or we can triple the expense later as we try to catch up. You have the power to invest not only in today's students, but in tomorrow's workforce and societal well-being. I love my job, but my job is getting more difficult and more exhausting because we're expected to do more with less all the time. And if we don't start funding it appropriately, we will not have the educators to teach Minnesota's children. Throughout the pandemic, we heard concerns about students falling behind and learned in real time just how important it was to have students in school. I am asking you to now legislate like it and give schools what they need so that they can give students what they need. We need the legislature to step up and invest wisely. We need state funding to keep up with inflation and the cost of living. Our schools and our kids deserve it, and unfortunately, this tax bill does not do that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Luger. Up next is Dr. Kelly. I'll let you say your last name for the record, and on deck is Karen Swenson. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Dr. Kelly Pilkisbach, and I'm an educator in Wiper Lake. I have been an elementary educator for the last 23 years. During that time, I have become an expert at doing more with less. I have begged and borrowed to provide resources for my students. But with an ever-widening income gap, institutional racism, and a global pandemic, my young students are coming to school hungry, sleep-deprived, and suffering from trauma. Minnesota kids deserve grown-ups, including those in this room, who make every financial decision with their best interest at heart. Money matters. Doing more with less is a myth that harms kids. Fully funding schools is an investment in the best teachers, lower class sizes, and higher graduation rates. A recent Learning Policy Institute survey of national data confirmed this. Per pupil funding directly impacts teacher quality, student mental health, class sizes, and graduation rates, just to name a few. The same study found that a mere 22% increase in per pupil funding is enough to eliminate the achievement gap. The proposed tax cuts in this bill send Minnesota schools and students the message that they don't matter, a message that has reverberated across our state since 2004. If the formula allowance was given even inflationary increases, my district would have an additional $2.3 million to support our students this year alone. Instead, my district is making $3.8 million in budget reductions, a loss of 22 teachers and 6 support staff. Most heartbreaking, these cuts will be felt most by the children and families who are already bearing the brunt of income inequality. This is not my Minnesota. In my Minnesota, kids matter. And if kids matter, funding their schools matters. Money matters. Public schools are worth it. They are the engine that powers democracy. Fully funding public schools is a moral imperative, especially when the children of Minnesota have done more with less for over 20 years. With a budget surplus, the time is now to show our Minnesota kids how much they matter. Thank you for listening, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Up is Ms. Karen Swenson. On deck, Mr. Matt Norris.
Hello, my name is Karen Swenson. I'm the executive director of Meadow Park Preschool and Child Care Center in Rochester, Minnesota. We are a small nonprofit preschool and child care center. And I've been in child care for over 30 years. When I started teaching in a toddler classroom, the typical wages were $6.37 an hour. Now, 30 years later, average wages in childcare are just over $12 an hour with no benefits. COVID has shown us that childcare is the backbone of our economy. Like almost every other community-based childcare center in Minnesota, we are turning away families because we have long waiting lists. We are in a crisis and on the brink of collapse. The Minnesota legislature has underfunded childcare and early education for decades. This year, we need to be different. This year, we have a $9.3 billion surplus. Yet, even with this huge surplus, what is your solution in the Senate? Rather than invest in our littlest Minnesotans, you plan to cut billions of dollars of taxes, much of which will benefit people who are very well off. Most Minnesotans do not pay taxes on their Social Security until they're making over $70,000 a year. Eliminating all taxes on Social Security means you are making a choice. You are choosing to hand money back to wealthy retirees who will probably go spend that money in another state anyway, rather than invest in our future. I urge you now to make a different choice. Make the right choice for our children, our future, and for our economy. choose to fund our children's future, not line the pockets of millionaires. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Swenson. Up next is Mr. Matt Norris. On deck, Nan Madden. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you're with and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Norris, and I'm the Policy Director and Director of Minnesota After School Advance at Youth Prize. I'm testifying today to encourage the committee to include the updated income limit for the K-12 education tax credit, which has been left out of the omnibus bill this year. As we discussed last week, this educational first aid for Minnesota students cannot wait. In just a couple of days since I last testified before the committee, one of our tutoring providers in Mankato reached out to me. They described a family making $40,000 who wanted to get math tutoring services for their fifth grader. The family can't afford it on their own, so they were hoping that they could use this tax credit. However, under the outdated income limit that hasn't changed since 1997, they didn't even fall within the phase-out range. The tutoring provider asked me if there was any way that I could make an exception. I had to explain that I couldn't. The limit was set by state law. Only the legislature can make those changes. So I'm coming before you today on behalf of that fifth grader in Mankato and every other student who needs this educational first aid. This committee has long taken the lead in championing updates to this tax credit. And a strong bipartisan group of senators, including many on this committee, support raising the income limit. At an estimated $12.2 million in fiscal year 23, updating the income limit represents less than one-half of 1% of the individual income tax provisions currently included in the bill. I hope you'll reconsider including this provision in the Senate's omnibus tax bill to get educational first aid to Minnesota students who need it more than ever right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Up next is Nan Madden. On deck, Cliff Adams. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today with serious concerns about Senate File 3692. This bill would spend the vast majority of the state's structural surplus on two expensive and poorly targeted tax cuts instead of making sustainable investments in public services so that everyday Minnesotans can thrive. Despite costing $6.8 billion over 3 years, the income tax rate reduction provides no benefit to about one in five Minnesota households, with modest income folks being the most likely to be left out. In contrast, the highest income Minnesotans would see average tax cuts of more than $1,000 each year. That's more than seven times the average tax cut a household with income under $30,000 would receive, and more than twice as big as what those making between $30,000 and $51,000 would see on average if they get a tax cut at all. These modest income Minnesotans do their part paying taxes to support public services. They just don't happen to pay them so much through the state's income tax, which is based on ability to pay. The Social Security proposal is also poorly targeted. Minnesota already takes a responsible and targeted approach to taxation of Social Security benefits. More than half of the total Social Security tax cuts would go to Minnesota households with incomes above $134,000 a year, and that's about the top 20% of the income distribution. The most struggling seniors would see no benefit, but would feel the greatest harm from a failure to invest in services today and from potential cuts to services in the future. This tax bill would spend 80% of the structural balance for the 24-25 biennium on tax cuts. That barely leaves enough to keep up with inflation or to respond to unintended consequences of the current global events. It doesn't leave enough to create a future that is stronger and more equitable than the pre-pandemic status quo. I urge you to instead focus on more targeted tax policies and make sustainable investments in childcare, family leave, affordable housing, a quality education from the earliest years through college and training, clean air and water, and other building blocks of a high-quality standard of living for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Up next is Cliff Adams, on deck Eric Bernstein. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, who you're with for the record, and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Vice Chair Coleman and members of the committee. My name is Cliff Adams, and I live in Minneapolis. For the last 4 years, I have worked as a nurse station tech at the M Health Fairview Riverside Hospital. In addition, I am a member of the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, and I serve as a union steward to our 1,500-plus members. Our union represents over 50,000 Minnesota healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. I'm here to testify about Senate File 3692. Like many Minnesotans, I will see a tax cut from this bill. I make about $20.89 an hour. Depending on the hours, I make between $26,000 to $35,000 a year. I file as a single person. According to your spreadsheet, someone like me will save somewhere between $260 to $549 a year in taxes. The extra money would be nice, but it does not address the most critical issues in my life. Almost every day since the start of the pandemic in March 2020, I have been in rooms directly caring for COVID-19 patients. I have been infected with COVID-19 twice, and I still worry about having to say goodbye to my mother 2,500 miles away over the phone. Instead of this tax cut, frontline workers like me need the COVID bonus that we were promised last session. My biggest worry is the short staffing at the hospital, which makes every day a nightmare. Healthcare workers need the state to invest in childcare and transportation so more people who can join the workforce and help staff our hospitals. Help with tuition would be the biggest thing that the state could do for students such as myself and many others in the workforce. Senate File 3692 also unfairly rewards higher income earners. I have a small pension plan at work. If I stay 20 years, I will qualify for a benefit of about $7,000 a year. This is far better than most people, but even with this, my retirement income is likely to be modest. I am very likely to fall into the category of Minnesotans who pay little or no tax on their Social Security. According to your documents, if my Social Security income was half my current wage, even with my pension, I could still only save as little as $61 a year. Even if I jump up to the next income bracket, I will only save $291 a year. At the same time, doctors, administrators with mid-six-figure salaries would save 5 to 6 times higher that amount, or 25 to 30 times the lower amount. The COVID epidemic has taught us just how many low-income workers are essential to our community. Everyone knows we couldn't function without nursing assistants, childcare workers, grocery workers, and teachers. Now is not the time for a tax cut that gives more benefits to higher income workers. In the summer of 2021, I had to take a 10-week unpaid leave. I knew that if I didn't get away from the stress and chaos of work, I would walk away from healthcare forever. During that leave, not once did I worry about my taxes. I worried about the care of my patients. I worried about having enough coworkers to do our job. I want a future where we invest in healthcare, childcare, education, and things that make a good community. Senate File 3692 will make it much harder to do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Eric Bernstein, on deck Amber Hansen-Glazer. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, thanks for having me here to testify. My name is Eric Bernstein, and I am policy director for We Make Minnesota, a coalition of labor and community groups united in support of a more equitable budget. I'm here today to express our concerns about SF3692, which contains two large permanent tax cuts that would disproportionately benefit higher-income Minnesotans while placing our state's long-term funding needs in jeopardy. The proposed first-tier income tax cut and Social Security tax exemption are projected to cost a combined $3.3 billion in the current budget and more than $5 billion over the 2024-25 biennium. Together, these cuts would consume more than 80% of the state's anticipated structural surplus. With inflation factored in, they would leave us in a functional deficit even before any of our urgent funding needs were addressed. For Minnesotans contending with understaffed schools, outdated infrastructure, scarce housing, and unaffordable childcare, this would be a disaster, and the minimal savings for most taxpayers would scarcely compensate. According to Senate analysis of the first-year income rate cut, households earning less than $50,000 per year would receive an average tax cut of $372, or roughly $7 per week. $7 per week will be cold comfort to thousands of families paying $200 to $300 every week for childcare while they sit on the wait list for state-funded assistance. $7 per week won't remove $7 per week won't remove lead from our water pipes, build affordable housing, or lower the cost of college. And $7 per week is misleadingly optimistic because it excludes more than 500,000 low-income households that would not benefit from these proposals at all. Top earners, of course, would fare much better. In the income provisions alone, SF3692 would allocate nearly $1 billion to lowering taxes for the top 20% every year for the next 3 years. And while low-income retirees who already pay little or no taxes on their benefits would be lucky to save $100 from the Social Security exemption, those making $250,000 or more would save an average well over $2,000. For all that's been made of this historic surplus, these nominal cuts would erase it almost entirely. What will we have to show for it? Minnesota is already spending 15% less on public goods and services than it did 3 decades ago as a share of the economy. Our schools are getting less per pupil, our water systems need repair, and local governments are increasingly turning to local option sales taxes to fund their basic community services and projects. The tax cuts contained in SF3692 will return very little to very many, a lot to very few, and they will prevent the solutions and shared investments that we need to keep our economy and our society strong. These tax cuts are not right for Minnesota, and we urge you to reject them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next is Amber Hansen-Glazer with the Farm Bureau.
Madam Chair, I'll be filling in for Amber Glazer, if that's all right with you.
Yes, that's fine. Just please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Caitlin Bemis, and I serve as the Public Policy Specialist for Minnesota Farm Bureau. I appreciate the opportunity to share this brief testimony on behalf of our nearly 30,000 members in support of the estate tax provisions included in Senate File 3692 as amended that will strengthen the tax code for Minnesota farmers and ranchers. Estate taxes can be a barrier to passing down farms to future generations by draining the financial resources of farmers and ranchers. At the federal level, portability of the estate tax exemption between married couples means that if the first spouse dies and the value of the estate tax does not require the use of all the deceased spouse's federal exemption amount, then the amount of the unused exemption may be transferred to the surviving spouse. This enables the surviving spouse to use the deceased spouse's unused exemption plus his or her own exemption when the surviving spouse later dies. However, Minnesota's estate tax laws do not allow for portability. To ensure that the tax code allows for flexibility in generational transfers, Minnesota Farm Bureau supports portability of the estate tax exemption. We appreciate the inclusion of the sections that will modify the Minnesota estate tax to allow for spousal portability provided for deceased spouse's unused exclusion amount that will allow for this important flexibility in the generational transitions of our family farms. I would also like to ask for your consideration of including the beginning farmer tax credit provisions that were heard in this committee last week. Minnesota Farm Bureau supports extending the beginning farmer tax credit to include the sale of agriculture assets to family members, which will help more young farmers and assist in generational farm transition. As any farmer will tell you, farm transitions are complex, costly, and seldom easy. Any new farmer in the land is a win for our rural communities and for the state as a whole. With support from a wide range of agriculture groups, changes to this innovative tax credit will continue to invest in the future of Minnesota agriculture. Again, thank you for including important changes to the Minnesota estate tax law in this legislation being considered today. Thank you so much for the work you have done on this committee, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. That's all the testifiers I have listed. Members, are there any questions? Senator Bach.
Well, I'll take the bait, Madam Chair. You know, one of the benefits of a bill like this is all of us at this table know that Minnesota has a very progressive tax system. And one of the challenges of that is when we hit a little hiccup in the economy, it has a huge impact on the state's revenue stream. So it's pretty easy for us in a very, very slight recession even to plunge into managing deficits. A revenue system that's really, really progressive has that vulnerability. And there are some of us in this legislature, and including Governor Dayton when he was here, that talked about moving towards a tax system that had more reliance on the sales tax, because it's a much more stable revenue stream. I think as we move forward, some version of this is going to get enacted into law, and I think the benefit of it is going to be we'll have a little bit less volatility in the future when that next recession comes. So, and second, you know, I think most of you, probably all of you, have been getting a lot of emails about putting more money into K-12 when we've got this surplus. I think it's unlikely that more money is going to end up on the K-12 formula. This is not a budget year. Well, let me just give a little homework to teachers, parents, school administrators, school board members. I got a call last week from a teacher up in northern Minnesota who said they've been without a contract for 8 months. And I asked why. And she said, because post-pandemic versus pre-pandemic, we've lost 250 students. And we don't know where they went. We think some of them, we know some of them went to homeschooling. We know some of them went to private schools. So I guess my homework for the educational system is sit down as a group, parents, school boards, and try to figure out why is it that large numbers of kids are leaving our K-12 school system. And in the case of this school district, and my two grandsons happen to go to school there, I mean, 250 students is about $2.5 million a year that's now gone out of the school district's budget because they've lost all those pupil units at about $10,000 each. So I think that's one of the major challenges I think that our school system's got to take a look at is why are so many kids or parents pulling their kids out of the public school system? And it's hurting the public school system because with everyone kind of on average, it's about $10,000. If you're in Minneapolis or St. Paul, it's about $12,000 that the school district loses for every kid that leaves. I just think our school system's got to figure out what is it that's going on because it's causing significant budget challenges in our K-12 system.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Senator Gazelka?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Tom Bach, well said. On that discussion, I think it's 22,000 students have left in the last 2 years and aren't coming back. And so if we want our public school system to be successful, we really need to know what the parents are thinking and why. But to this bill in particular, you know, we're near the top five tax states and in the whole country. So it isn't about not having enough money in Minnesota. What are we doing with the money? But our goal should be to get out of the top 10 tax states. And if you look at some of the key parts of this bill, lowering the lowest income tax affects everyone. And cutting that in half, I think, is really wise. And you think about what that does when our lowest tax rate right now is higher than the highest tax rate of 17 states, I think we're out of line. And over and over and over, I hear seniors across the state saying, just get rid of the Social Security income tax entirely. And if you're 70,000, like somebody mentioned that as a number, that's the kind of person that's willing to go out of state and be in a different state because they don't want to pay that tax in Minnesota. We need our seniors in Minnesota. They're a key to our future. They're going to be some of our workforce shortage that we have is going to be seniors that want to be back in work. They're the ones that help take care of grandkids. They're the ones that are philanthropic. And so the two big provisions that I particularly like that are in this bill, I think will make a big difference in Minnesota and send a message to seniors that we don't want them to leave our state. If they leave because it's cold, I get that one, but no other reason. So I'm very supportive of this bill. And Senator Nelson, you did a great job on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Would any other members like to speak? Well, seeing none, I just want to say on a personal note, thank you, Senator Nelson, for all of your work on this bill. Speaking as someone who is raising little kids in today's economy, I can tell you that Minnesota families were being squeezed and were being squeezed hard. We live in a modest home. We buy groceries on sale. And we can't go into Target for two items, formula and diapers, without spending $100 twice a week. It's $400 a month to go to work and back just for my job. And Minnesota families are getting squeezed in every single aspect of their budget, and they really do need relief. And any relief, let alone the largest tax cut proposed in the history of Minnesota, it will go a long way. And it says right at the top of our sheets here that fairness, adequacy, simplicity, neutrality, and transparency are key components of what we strive for here, and I do believe this bill achieves that. So thank you for bringing that forward, and if you have any closing comments, I'd love to hear them.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, it is time that we use this large historic surplus to really right-size our tax code to empower Minnesotans. And Senator Coleman, I'm glad you brought up our mission at the top of every agenda that goes out. And as we talk about good tax policy, I just want to listen, as you read that, fairness, adequacy, we'll read all the others, but let's just focus on that second word, adequacy. The tax policy we currently have is more than adequate, folks. We have over a $9 billion surplus. So the proposal before you today is an effort to provide that much-needed permanent tax relief to all Minnesota taxpayers. If you pay income taxes, you're going to see a reduction.
Okay.
And also, if you, we know how important it is for, to try and keep our seniors here as well. And I would just add one thing that was mentioned as well, and that is we are a highly progressive tax state. We are one of the most progressive tax states in the nation. And our lowest rate is higher than the highest rate of many states. So we overtax our citizens. And it's essential that we use this opportunity to use this historic surplus at a time of 40-year inflation, a historic inflation, to provide that much-needed relief for Minnesotans. Members, tomorrow we will be, just to note, we will be meeting tomorrow. The Tax Committee will be meeting on Wednesday, our full Tax Committee, and we will be doing the Chair's Mark, Chair's Amendments tomorrow.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And with that, Senate File 3692 is laid over. And we are adjourned until tomorrow morning, Wednesday, April 6, 2022. Thank you.